Do you remember the age you were when you realized what you could do with money? How many pieces of bubble gum a nickel will buy, or a dime, or a quarter? That would really be something. I don't remember when it all began for me, but children, of course, learn at a very early age the pull and the power of money. A man came home from work one day and his 3-year-old daughter was there, and he asked his daughter, do you have a kiss for your daddy? And she said, no. And he said, well, that hurts my feelings. I've worked all day hard to bring home money, and this is how you treat me? Come on, where's my kiss? She said, where's my money? From our earliest years, the God of money teaches us that we deserve our cut. The counterfeit God convinces us that the more money we have, the happier we'll be. Kyle Idleman, in his book, Gods at War, wrote, sometimes we hear rich people say things like, money doesn't make you happy, and most of us think that they all flew first class to some exotic destination where they got together and agreed to say that to the rest of us. Someone wants to define money as an article which may be used as a universal passport to everywhere except heaven, and as a universal provider for everything except happiness. That's pretty good. Years ago, Brad Pitt, of course, well-known movie star, he did an interview, and in the interview he responded to people's illusion that since he was, of course, incredibly successful and wealthy, that he had a perfect life. And here's what he said. He said, once you've got everything, then you just left with yourself. And it doesn't help you sleep any better, and you don't wake up any better because of it. And so tonight, our challenge is to grow some, continue to develop the right attitude toward money and all the things, of course, that money can purchase. But here's where the rubber meets the road. The person who has God and has much of what this world offers has no more than a person who has God and has little of what this world has to offer. But most people don't believe that, right? Most people don't. Do you? Of course, Jesus made it clear that you can't serve God and mammon, or some versions say money. You remember what he said about treasures and hearts in Matthew 6, 19, 20, and 21. He said, do not lay up for yourselves treasures on earth where moth and rust destroy and where thieves break in and steal. But lay up for yourselves treasures in heaven where neither moth nor rust destroys and where thieves do not break in and steal. For where your treasure is, there your heart will be also. And later there in Matthew 6, verse 24, you'll recognize this verse. Jesus said, no one can serve two masters. For either he'll hate the one and love the other, or else he'll be loyal to one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. Some versions again have money. And so here's the bottom line. When you try to serve the counterfeit God of money while also serving the true Almighty God, you're going to end up serving money because that's where your heart will be. Mark Twain. I don't quote Mark Twain much in sermons, but he said some things that'll make you think, didn't he? He said, some men worship rank. Some worship heroes. Some worship power. Some worship God. And over these ideals, they dispute and cannot unite because they all worship money. Well, hopefully he's not right. Because you can't serve God or worship God and money also. The scariest part about this is that most folks are blind to how powerful our culture of greed is in America. And the grip of greed that often has hold on their hearts and they don't even realize it. The biblical writers, and especially Jesus, had a lot to say about this, about money. In fact, there are over 450 different passages in the Bible dealing with money. It's the second most dominant subject, only behind idolatry. Almost one out of six statements made by Jesus, guess what they deal with? Our subject tonight. Money. Possessions. Wealth. Of the 38 parables that Jesus shared, 16 of them deal with money. And yet, almost no one thinks that they're guilty of greed. Satan's really good at what he does. And greed, that's the real problem, not money, because money in and of itself is not good or bad. Greed, the real problem, is centered on often the love of money, also known as greed. 1 Timothy 6:10 is often misquoted. For money is the root of all kinds of evil. That's not what it says. That's leaving out a word or two. For the love of money is a root, just one of them, a root of all kinds of evil, for which some have strayed from the faith in their greediness and pierced themselves through with many sorrows. Again, it's not money, it's the love of money. That's the root of all kinds of evil. And it's because of the love of money that many have strayed from the faith. And here's the important phrase in that verse. In their greediness. Tonight we're going to take a look at a couple of people described by this passage. The first one is found in Luke chapter 12. The rich fool. One day Jesus was teaching when a man in the crowd spoke up with a request. Luke 12:13. Teacher, tell my brother to divide the inheritance with me. And this was probably a younger brother or one of the younger brothers. Culture and Levitical law gave the oldest brother two shares. And if it was just the two of them, he got two-thirds and the younger son got one-third. But he didn't want one-third. And Jesus replies, Luke 12:14, man, who made me a judge or an arbitrator over you? And Jesus uses this to teach the danger of serving the counterfeit god of money. Luke 12:15. And he said to him, take heed and beware of covetousness, for one's life does not consist in the abundance of the things he possesses. And so Jesus is going to make it clear. Life is not about money and possessions. And then he told this story. Verse 16. Then he spoke a parable to them, saying, the ground of a certain man, you're going to recognize this parable. The ground of a certain man, certain rich man yielded plentifully. And he thought within himself, saying, now I want you to pay attention. I underlined them here in my notes. All the I's and the my's. He thought within himself, saying, "What shall I do, since I have no room to store my crops?" So he said, "I will do this. I will pull down my barns and build greater, and there I will store all my crops and my goods. And I will say to my soul, 'Soul, you have many goods laid up for many years. Take your ease, eat, drink, and be merry.' But God said to him, 'Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided?' So is he," verse 21, "so is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich toward God." And so how can we be sure this man is serving the God of money? Just count the I's and the my's, right? 11 times. And with that, there's no acknowledgement that all this wealth came as a blessing from God. He didn't even entertain the idea of sharing it with others, the needy, because he was laying up treasure for himself. God wasn't in the picture. Here's the bottom line. The key to keeping money in its rightful place is to remember, unlike this man, remember that it all belongs to God. All good things, where's the source according to James? God. And so God has loaned it to us and we're stewards of it. I love Psalm 24:1, little two sentences. "The earth is the Lord's. The earth belongs to the Lord in all its fullness, the world and those who dwell therein." That is profound when you really understand it and believe it. Kyle Ottman in his book, I thought this was really good. He said, "God's given us the use of his resources for a short time here on earth. And we have much to be grateful for. Go through your day sometimes just recognizing that everything is God's. Get out of God's bed and walk into God's bathroom. Turn on God's shower and then put on God's clothes. Eat God's cereal and drink God's coffee. Get in God's car and head to work. When we start to see all of our resources as belonging to God, it helps us develop an attitude of gratitude that leads to a heart of worship. Think about how this rich fool was looking at his money to do all the things that God should have been doing for him. By the way, that's the heart and core of idolatry. First, he looked to money as his source of security. Man, he laid up all he needed for years. He was set. Do you know anybody trying to accumulate enough wealth and possessions and whatever so that they can finally feel set with no worries? That's kind of like the guy when I was selling real estate. He bought a 15,000 acre ranch and he said, "You know, really, the only land I want is what adjoins me." Now, he said that with a grin because that's not how he really felt. But when we look to money as security, it becomes our God. We serve it. Secondly, money was his source of satisfaction. Just lay back, eat, drink, and be merry. His satisfaction had nothing to do with pleasing God, had nothing to do with having a relationship with God. But it all came from money and what it could buy. Money was his source of satisfaction. And then thirdly, money was his source of significance. His focus was on himself, on his wealth. Others were going to respect him now. He had the biggest barns in town. Well, maybe in the country. They were going to envy him. man, look at what he's got. They would be ready to listen to his opinions. The God of money wants us to believe that our significance comes from what we make of ourselves. So our self-worth is a product of our net worth. Satan's lie. Well, his retirement plans, as we read, didn't work out. God said to him, "Fool, this night your soul will be required of you. Then whose will those things be which you have provided?" Not which God had provided, but which you provided. And so he learned the folly of trying to serve the God of money. Here's my favorite character, though, in the Bible. In Luke chapter 19, we're all familiar with the story of Zacchaeus, a chief tax collector. Not just a tax collector, he was a chief tax collector living in Jericho. Now, that does not equate to working with the IRS today. Because in that day and time, Jewish tax collectors were taking money from Jews and handing it over to the Roman government. And so most Jews considered that to be treason. And so why would any Jew take that job? You know you're going to be abhorred by your countrymen. Why would you do it? Money, money, and more money. Three reasons. Tax collectors were among the wealthiest people in Israel. And yes, they were also among the most hated and branded as the worst of sinners. When Zacchaeus heard that Jesus was coming through town, he did a very unusual thing for a wealthy man. He actually shimmied up a tree to get a good look at Jesus. Because the wee little man was vertically challenged. And forget it. No one was going to step aside and let him through to the front of the line. He was hated. And so pushed to the back of the crowd, he did what desperate men do. He decided it was worth looking like a fool to get a look at Jesus, to put his eyes on Jesus. In a culture where honor and dignity were prized, he no longer cared about that. Despite the enormous ridicule. And don't you know people were standing around that tree laughing? They had to be. Look at him. He still climbed the sycamore tree. But his willingness to climb the tree revealed something about Zacchaeus. He was, in fact, desperate. Although he had more money than he knew what to do with, he knew that something was missing from his life. And apparently, he had a notion that maybe Jesus could provide what he was missing. So, Jesus walks under the tree. Verse 5, Luke 19:5. When Jesus came to the place, he looked up and saw him. Can you imagine what was in Zacchaeus' heart when he looked up at him? Oh, no. But he didn't condemn him. He said to him, "Zacchaeus, make haste and come down, for today I must stay at your house." That reminds me of John 4 when Jesus said, "I must go through Samaria. I must go to your house, stay at your house." So he made haste and came down and received him joyfully. But when they saw it, they all complained. They all complained, saying, "He's gone to be a guest with a man who's a sinner." Can you imagine what was going through Zacchaeus' mind when Jesus said, "Come on, get in. I'm going to your house." Jesus invited himself to visit that tax collector in his home. Jesus chose him. He called him by name. He wanted to break bread with him. And in that instant, what happened to Zacchaeus? Well, one thing's for sure, his spiritual understanding began to change. He was drawn to Jesus, wanted to follow Jesus, and obviously he knew that This meant that his relationship with money must change. And so there in his home, in front of Jesus and his guests, the fruits of repentance were clearly seen. Verse 8, then Zacchaeus stood and said to the Lord, "Lord, look, Lord, I give half of my goods." That's a fortune, or at least half a fortune. "I give half of my goods to the poor. And if I've taken anything by anyone, from anyone by false accusation, I restore fourfold." Listen to me. Zacchaeus tore himself away from the god of money and surrendered to serve and to worship the Son of God. 50% was going to go to the poor. Not of what he had in the bank, but everything he had. Going to the poor. He would repay anyone that he had cheated fourfold. Can you imagine how long that line was? You know some people lined up on that deal, right? Have you ever heard of anyone who thought the IRS was taking more money than they should? Of course. Were they happy about it? No. And ramp that up about 1,000 times in the first century. But Zacchaeus turned from the love of money. He rejected greed and covetousness. And now he wanted Jesus and Jehovah God to do for him what money could never do. The good news is Jesus is still changing lives in the same way. What he did for Zacchaeus, he does for us. God will help us see the counterfeit god of money and greed and covetousness for what it is. We have to be willing to see. We have to initiate that change. But the good news is we don't have to end up like the rich fool of Luke 12. So, here's some questions I want to send you home with. How often do you compare what you have and what you earn to others? Have you got past that? Our world and the god of money encourage us to measure our life and our worth by our money and possessions. We simply must resist that temptation. Jesus reminds us a person's life doesn't consist in the abundance of their possessions or how big their bank account is. Secondly, how much anxiety do finances add to your life? Here's an interesting thing. The people who are really, really wealthy, guess what they worry about the most? Losing their money. And at the other end of the extreme, and all of us are either there or have been there, we regularly face financial challenges. How do we face those? Anxiety? Worry? Do we trust in our own efforts alone? Or do we say, "God, I'm going to put this in your hands. I'm going to live true to you and let you provide." That doesn't mean you don't work hard. But you don't live in agony. And then thirdly, to what extent are your dreams and goals driven by money? I have a real good preacher friend, and I saw on Facebook, I don't put much on Facebook, but I read what my family mainly puts on there. And he said, "Boy, I wish I had millions of dollars in a big garage like Jay Leno so I could have all those cars." And I wanted to call him up and say, "You dipstick, you know better than that." He wasn't serious about it. Couldn't be. Because that's really not something that'll make you happy. It'll give you a lot of worry. What do you think would happen if you won the lottery? Yeah, you'd immediately have a lot of new people who say they want to be your friends. Yeah, I mean, you study the history and what happens to most lottery winners. They they're broke in a short amount of time and even more miserable. That doesn't mean that everybody wins the lottery. That happens to them. I know someone in Ada that won it, and he's super involved with his church. Would you feel differently about yourself if you had more money? If you had more money, would you be more likely to spend more of it on yourself? Would you build bigger barns? Would you say, hey, I'm going to go on bigger vacations. This is going to be great. That's what the man in Luke 12 did. I'll eat, drink, and be merry. I want to close this with this little thing that this guy wrote in his book. It's called Jesus, My Provider. The God of money was almost irresistible. He spun tales of sports cars and luxury homes and all the good things he was going to buy for us. Yes, we had heard the old refrain that money can't buy happiness. We knew that. We'd seen what it had done to people over and over, but we were going to be different. We would know how to use money without letting it use us. But we didn't want to buy happiness. We just wanted to rent a little pleasure. But somewhere it all went wrong. Somehow the God of money became our slave driver. He kept us running, following him, trying to keep him from getting away. We followed not the yellow brick road, but the green brick road, until we longed for rest. We put our hope in what we might find at the end of the rainbow. We thought money would provide us with security and significance and at least some measure of satisfaction. But strangely, even when we had money, we still felt broke. And then we chose Jesus. Y'all relate? Then we chose Jesus and discovered that He is our provider. He provides everything we need. He provides us with security because He never leaves us nor forsakes us. He provides us with significance because our identity and value are found in His love. He provides us with satisfaction because our souls were made for Him. We discovered that God would meet all our needs according to the riches of His glory in Christ Jesus. Maybe that's the story of your life. But that last paragraph should be the story of all our lives. We found Jesus and everything changed. Tonight, if you need to come, please come forward now while we stand and sing.